Welcome to Countersign. This is Stuart Mota. Countersign is a podcast where we discuss books, films, and other materials with their authors and creators. Discussions are built on slow reading and attentiveness to ideas. You can tune in wherever you get your podcasts or on countersignisapodcast.com. You can receive updates by following me on Blue Sky or LinkedIn. If you're ever in search of an intellectual who embodies Gramsci's injunction that what is needed is a pessimism of the intellect and an optimism of the will, you need not go past Seppo Madlingozi. I'm immensely proud that Seppo completed his PhD at Birkbeck Law School under the supervision of Professor Patricia Tewitt and myself, although that was many years ago and he has gone on to achieve many other incredible things in South Africa. In 2024, Madlingozi was appointed by the President of South Africa as one of seven human rights commissioners, which is a national post mandated by the Constitution. He leads on anti-racism, education, and equality. Among several academic posts he has held is his recent appointment as Extraordinary Professor at the Center for Social Justice at Stellenbosch University. I met Seppo over 20 years ago, thanks to my friend Karen Van Mala, who introduced him to me. At the time, I was traveling fairly regularly to South Africa, fascinated by the constitutional arrangements and the post-apartheid era that Karl Clare and others referred to as transformative constitutionalism. For a world emerging out of the Cold War and embracing, supposedly, an era of human rights, South Africa symbolized one of the greatest of crimes against humanity being defeated by an extraordinary struggle and resistance movement, and the adoption of a constitutional process for the era that followed. We are now 30 years from those historically and juridically momentous events. It is 30 years since the Truth and Reconciliation Commission began its hearings, and the South African Constitution was also adopted in 1996. And yet, the legacy is not far from the stench of shit dumps and the tragedy of dead miners that continues to hit the news in South Africa and the world. Seppo and I took stock of this post-apartheid era when he was visiting London a few weeks ago. Our conversation ranges from the racial capitalism and environmental racism that are the conditions of colonialism, apartheid, and indeed the supposedly post-apartheid era, and we consider how the Constitution has featured in the debates. The notion of constitutionalism without constitution is a paradox, and it manifests the contradiction that there is a deep modernist constitution in place, whilst there hasn't been a reconstitution of the world-breaking and world-destroying relations that were brought about by colonialism and apartheid. Our conversation teases out the many issues that give effect to the absence of reconstitution of social and economic relations in South Africa. Seppo Madlingozi, welcome to Countersign. I should actually say Dr. Madlingozi or Professor Madlingozi or indeed Commissioner Madlingozi, because you are one of South Africa's seven human rights commissioners. You also did a PhD at Birkbeck, and it's wonderful to have you back here in London. I haven't seen you for about 10 years, and it's been great to catch up with you. You have been doing so much, activism, teaching, now working as Commissioner of Human Rights, appointed by the President of South Africa. And we are talking at a time when 2026 is the 30th anniversary of the Truth and Reconciliation Commission starting its hearings. And it's also the 30th anniversary of the South African Constitution adopted in 1996. So there are these great events of a juridical and constitutional character, but minors are dying in South Africa and in other parts of Africa. Where are we at, Seppo? What's happening with the deaths of these minors, the mudslide?
First of all, thank you so much for inviting me to the podcast. I've been envious looking at you inviting so many people and say, when am I coming on the podcast? And so congratulations. It's a wonderful podcast. I've just listened to the latest episode, which was really not only touching, but also very enlightening. So congratulations on project. And it's an honor to be here. Yes, indeed. 2 weeks ago, we had an incident in South Africa where five miners were trapped because of a mudslide in the Northern Cape in Kimberley. You will know Kimberley was the first site of the discovery of diamonds in South Africa. So a very significant site in the constituting of this country that we now call South Africa. So we really want to start by paying condolences to the family of the dead. They are now presumed dead. The rescue effort has been abandoned because, it's been about 2 weeks now. Yes. So it's really sad. But at the same time, we've just received news that 2 days ago in the Democratic Republic of Congo, between 100 and 200 miners also trapped in a mine, a mudslide, also the same issue. Now, for me, this issue is a bit closer to home.
Yes.
Because, of course, my father was a mine worker. He worked in a gold mine in the Free State.
In Welkom.
In Welkom. Yes. Welkom, meaning welcome, but nothing welcoming.
Nothing
about
welcoming
that
about
place.
Welkom, yes.
At the time, it was the site of the biggest discovery of the gold deposits in South Africa.
Yes. And this is during, I mean, give us a sense of the timing here. This is height of apartheid.
This is height of apartheid. This is a time when we can even say that apartheid is at its closer to its death, demise, because it's in the 80s. It's in the 80s. A very violent time because there's anti-apartheid resistance and protests, but the apartheid state is also going all out to do this. So my father worked in this mining company. And he
was a miner. I mean,
he was a miner, a miner. And he dies, still working there, doesn't die because of an accident, a heart attack. But yes, a very...
He had a heart attack.
He had a heart attack. Yes. A sore point for me because he would only come home every 6 months, every 4 months.
Yes.
Even after we moved closer to be in this mining town.
Oh, is that right?
But he lived in the barracks, in a sense. But after he dies in 1994, February 1994, we had this incident of a mudslide in Welkom where a number of people died. And of course, the people who were mostly affected were the mine workers, but also people who lived in so-called informal settlement in the shanty towns because of the structures. That time, my mom was working as a nurse. So I remember my mom working for 3 nights nonstop, trying to assist with this problem. So we're talking 1994. It's now 2026, which shows not only the continuities of the exploitation of mine workers, but it also shows that the mining sector as a whole has not reformed or transformed well enough to ensure that these incidents don't happen. Of course, accidents happen, but when we were dealing with a mudslide, there was another mudslide incident, I think, 6-7 years ago in the Free State, almost where the first incident happened, in where when I was living in the Free State. So it shows this continuity.
Yeah. So it's the sort of racial capitalist infrastructure that you're describing that was in place during apartheid, where families are separated. You know, your father can only travel to see his family, you know, maybe 3-4 times a year maximum. And when you were living, and of course that violence, that violence of extraction of minerals, of gold. You mentioned the recent tragedy in the DRC as well, that this is continuing. You know?
That's
so
right.
What was happening in the 1980s is actually also continuing now. And say a little bit more about what you encountered, you know, when you as a child were living close to these mines. What was the atmosphere and the conditions like?
Well, we have to go back and say the reason why settler colonialism in South Africa is not of an exterminating type is because you needed this cheap labor for mining, for manufacturing. So that's the only reason or part of the reason why there's no extermination. So you set up this mining conglomerates. You destroy the subsidence farming of these people and you force them to pay tax. And they can only pay tax by working, working in the farms, working in the mines. So we need to start there because it is what I describe as the start of the death of the world of African people. So death of the world is an expression that is used by black people, indigenous people from the 1700s. You'll recall that South Africa, unlike most African countries, colonialism started in the 17th century, 1652, 1654, up to 1994, whatever. So a longer duration of colonialism, almost at the same time when the Americas were being colonized, you know, in the 1500s and so forth. So the more there was conquest, colonization, land disposition, black people used to shout, "Ilizwe lifile, ilizwe lifile." The literal translation is that the nation is dead. But when you listen and you understand what they actually meant, they meant the world is dead.
So the sort of life world, I mean, we were talking about how there's now much contemporary literature. We were having a look at David Scott's book yesterday.
Excellent book.
On irreparable evil. And there is a, and I was talking also about Jonathan Lear's book, Radical Hope, and the way in which indigenous people talk about a life world being destroyed, and that's what you're referring to.
Absolutely, absolutely. Yeah. That was at the center of my PhD that you referred to here at Bebe, which was, you know, settler colonization is not really only about conquest, colonization, and displacement. It's really ultimately about the shattering of the social cultural world of indigenous people. So when black people say the world is dead, they meant it at three levels of African being in the world. They meant, first of all, the social world is dead in the sense that you've introduced a world where there's no interpersonal equality and relations. Now, you will know that indigenous people of South Africa, people of Ubuntu, I am because you are, and therefore we are together, you know, harmony, interdependence, communalism. Now, you introduce this world of hierarchies where some people are below the level of the human, in a sense. But they also meant the death of the material world because displacement, dispossession meant that people were disconnected from the land. And of course, for African people, land is not simply an economic, a material being or matter. It's also about identity. It's about belonging. It's about where you perform rituals to connect with your ancestors, your gods. Without land, you can't perform those. So you are nothing. In a sense, you are a cosmic hobo. So, but also it meant a severance from the none or more than human beings. Because you are unable to take care of the animals. You are unable to be in the in that interdependent relationship with so-called nature, Mother Earth. But it also meant the death of the spiritual world. Because, of course, if you can't perform these rituals, if you don't have land, there's no culture without land. Without land, there's no culture. There's no identity. So they talked about this. The spiritual world has been fractured. Mm-hmm. Some of them will even say the gods have abandoned us mm-hmm. because we believe that our gods will protect us against mm-hmm. this invasion. So, yes, that was at the center of my PhD. That's why the title was something about belongingness mm-hmm. and constituting. And part of my PhD was about decolonization mm-hmm. or independence. It's about how you reconstitute
yes.
these life worlds, these worlds that have been fractured. And yeah. what does that mean so to do that?
There's a destruction of life worlds at these multiple levels mm. over centuries mm-hmm. of colonization. Mm. And at a time when other parts of the world were decolonizing.
That's right.
At least in juridical terms, because mm. Colonization continues and imperialism continues in mm. other ways. South Africa digs its heels in with mm. The National Party and the apartheid state. Mm. And then you have another sort of 50 years of that racial state.
Desire.
But then there is a moment in 1994, which you're, you know, referring to also the mining tragedy. Mm. So there's these continuities of mm. World-destroying, resource-extracting, mm. which goes hand in hand. And at the same time, there is the emergence of what people, in a very utopian way and a romantic way, were referring mm. to as the rainbow nation, and the release of Nelson Mandela from prison, mm. the democratic and constitutional process. And mm. I think there's a real sense now of taking stock of that moment. So how do you analyze that moment of 1994 to 1996 and the emergence mm. of the Truth and Reconciliation Commission and the constitutional model? Because the South mm. African constitution, of course, is spoken of very highly as having That's this right. extremely evolved modern constitution with mm. not only the guarantee of civil and political rights, but also social and economic rights. Yeah. And it's seen as a high point of modernist constitutionalism.
No, absolutely. It was a moment of hope, mm-hmm. of course. I grew up and lived in the 80s, the most violent time in the history of South Africa. Mm-hmm. People often forget that more people were killed during the period mid-1980s to 1990s. That small period, 10 years,
yeah.
more people were killed than in the political violence that at any point in the history of this place called South Africa. Mm-hmm. More than 20,000 killed, a lot disappeared, and we grew up with this overt violence, you know, violent in your face, people mm-hmm. being killed, people being disappeared, people being tortured, and so forth. So the end of that represents hope, in a sense, hope that finally there will be peace. I mean, I remember as a young child, I had to hide in the ceilings because people from Inkatha were coming to kill us, Inkatha being a Zulu nationalist party that allegedly was propped up by apartheid. Mm-hmm. And there was this war between it and the ANC. And a lot of people were killed. So I remember hiding in the bushes, hiding in the ceiling. So the end of that represents hope. Mandela coming out of jail and a lot of hope. So it was a hopeful moment for a lot of people in Africa. It was also a hope because this was the last place that was still colonized, still under apartheid, still under oppression. Mm-hmm. So a lot of hope internationally. Is the first country that is constituted after the fall of the wall.
Yes.
You know, there was Namibia. Yeah,
the Cold War. And
the Cold War, but yeah. South Africa is, someone say, in the age of rights.
Yes.
It's the one there. And then, of course, it was not a conflict, so-called conflict, that ends because one party was successful in the war. So there had to be a negotiated settlement.
Mm-hmm. And a compromise.
And a compromise.
Sense, what you get when you have a negotiated settlement,
there must be
when
a
you
compromise.
Make peace, is mm. that you have a compromise. And what is, in a sense, being questioned now is the nature of that compromise.
That's right. So the critique is at two levels. That people who say there should never have been negotiations. We should have fought and won as black people. Now, that's naive. Mm-hmm. That's naive because the apartheid state not only had a very strong army, the strongest army in Africa. So no African country would have come to our aid. You know, forget about that. Cuba did assist us, but as part of the agreement, Cuba pulled out. In fact, Cuba is responsible for the end of apartheid, in a sense, because of part of the agreement for it pulling out of Angola is right. That Mandela must be freed and so forth. But Cuba has pulled out. The United States of America, Britain, still supporting apartheid. So mm-hmm. apartheid state has got these powerful allies. So they had to be compromised. There had to be negotiation. But as you said, what is questioned is the nature of that compromise. The nature of the compromise says there will be political freedom without economic freedom. You will take over the democratic government, you'll take over the government, but the economic structure will remain the same. Mm-hmm. There will be affirmative action, there will be black economic empowerment, but of a thin layer of people. Mm-hmm. Political freedom without economic freedom is meaningless. In the context where the conflict, I use the conflict very loosely here because it was not conflict, it was a war against indigenous people. But yeah. Let's use the word conflict for now. At the heart of the conflict was racial apartheid, racial capitalism, mm-hmm. that you need to colonize these people to exploit them, you know, racially, as racial bodies, as cheap labor, yeah. as tools.
And let's not lose the substance and materiality of that, because we often brush past it. Mm-mm. But there was a stench. It was the smell of shit, right?
That's right.
I mean,
That's
that is
right.
what you encountered when you had to, with your family, go and
literally. When we moved to this place in the Free State, next to Welcome, we literally lived opposite a shit dump, yeah. meaning a sewage dump.
Yeah.
Now, the sewage was coming from the white suburbs. So white people would do their thing. It would be pumped to literally 10 feet away from where I lived. So we are living in this place where you smell shit. In your clothes, your textbooks, your food, everywhere, the smell, until you get used to it, actually. Mm-hmm. But you can imagine going with this, not bitterness, but anger, mm-hmm. that our lives are worthless compared to this other people's lives. Mm. That for their hygiene, for their sanitation, we have to suffer for that. Mm-hmm.
So they pump the shit out of their suburbs.
That's right.
And apartheid enforces living conditions and segregation, where black people have to live next to the shit dump.
That's right.
And in 1994 to 1996, there is a sort of glossing over of these material conditions, and we are seeing that the mining catastrophes that we continue to see, in a sense, mark the continuities, their real material continuities, what was happening in the 1980s and 90s and what is happening now. So just to keep that in mind when we're...
Because it's often we go and
have debates about the Constitution and we forget that actually this is the material conditions.
No, people are dying. Yeah. You'll recall a few years ago, miners were killed in a place called Marikana.
Marikana, yeah.
34 miners, you know, miners who... mostly shot in the back.
Yes.
You can look at the documentaries, you can look at YouTube, when it happens.
Yes.
You know, miners are walking away.
Yeah. They're protesters. They were striking workers.
For wages.
For better working conditions
and wages. And of course they want more wages because they're trapped in a debt because they're not earning more, so they have to get into these loan shark agreements. Mm-hmm. So they're always broke. And they get killed. And up to now, no one has gone to jail. Killed broad daylight, but also premeditated. Mm-hmm. There's no doubt that it was premeditated murder. You know, the previous day, vans for the mortuaries are brought in preparation to cut these people away.
Right.
Why do you need that?
Yes.
You know, if you look at the amount of ammunition that is brought to the scene,
yes.
This was not public order policing.
Yes.
So when I write about it, I say Marikana was a spectacular representation of the continuation of the cheapness of black life under this racial capitalism. It was not an aberration. Mm. It was just spectacular. But every day, black people are dying slow death. You can imagine how many people that lived around the shit dump contracted so many diseases that were not even diagnosed. You can imagine miners like my father working in the mine, they contract lung diseases. silicosis is called, and when they're unable to work, they're brought back to the villages, right. They're dumped back to their families. The continuation is so stark, as you say, it's not metaphorical, it is not philosophical. People are dying even today, mm-hmm. even under conditions of democracy, mm-hmm. even under conditions of constitutional or constitutionalism. So those continue. So for me, that was my first encounter with something called environmental racism. Mm-hmm. But we can even call it environmental colonization, because we didn't have a choice to move. Mm-hmm. You know, mm-hmm. you couldn't say, oh, we don't want to live here, we'll go elsewhere. You know, you encounter this. And even before I moved to this place, the place where I grew up, I was born, we lived opposite a dump for for white people. So white people will, you know, their litter, their garbage was dumped at this place. And so, you know, environmental racism also does continue today. Black people continue to live in spaces where there's environmental pollution. Black people continue to live in places where there's dolomites, you know, where the earth is giving in, mm-hmm. because of this blasting of the mines. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. When I was the director of the Center for Applied Legal Studies, we did this research which shows that in one place, there was a lot of miscarriages, a lot of stillbirths. We could not prove connection to the mine. Mm-hmm. But surely, if you look at the blasting, the pollution, and these disproportionate miscarriages, mm-hmm. you can see a link mm-hmm. between the mm-hmm. two. Mm.
So these are the material manifestations of the ongoing violence mm. that is happening in South Africa and also in other parts of the colonized world. What are the reflections on the South African Constitution and the Truth and Reconciliation Commission? Because those were the pivots. They're the juridical pivots. They're the political pivots for attempting to reconstitute this society. You know, what are your reflections on that?
Yes, as you say, the South African Constitution is often exported even mm-hmm. in Zimbabwe, different places, just copy and paste the South African Constitution, even Kenya to a certain extent, but also is constitutional court jurisprudence are cited by other people. So well-regarded, very expansive constitution, as you say, not only civil and political rights, but also socio-economic rights. So it's a transformative constitutionalism. Mm-hmm. It's not a decolonizing constitution. It's a transforming constitution. The difference is significant between a constitution that transforms and a constitution that actually seeks to decolonize, a constitution that makes it possible for people, black people, to vote. So there are positives.
So that's what's transformative about it.
That's transformative, that black people can vote.
Yes.
Black people, you know, don't have to fear the police coming at midnight to come kidnap your father or your mother or your child. So it's transformative.
So the security state that functioned during apartheid comes to an end. It's not to say that there aren't...
It gets dismantled.
Yes.
It gets dismantled. The security branch, as we call it, some of its intelligence, a little bit, gets dismantled. So it's transformative in a sense that, number one, black people are citizens.
Yes.
We're not citizens before. For the first time, we are citizens. Mm-hmm. Two, meaning that we can vote. Mm-hmm. Three, meaning that I can live where I want to live.
Yes.
If I can afford it.
Yes.
I can live where I can live. If I can afford it.
Yes.
I've got socio-economic rights, meaning the right to access to water, electricity, access to education.
Although with privatization.
With privatization, but as it says in the Constitution itself, within available resources.
Right.
Progressively. Not now, but progressively. So on paper, very good. But of course, we did not talk about the other 30th anniversary, which is the adoption of a macroeconomic policy called the Growth and Redistribution Program, GEAR. Mm-hmm. But of course, it was reverse GEAR. There was nothing progressive about it. So the ANC comes to power on the basis of a social welfare, social democratic policy called the Reconstruction and Development Program, mm-hmm. 2 years later, Mandela, President Mandela scraps it and adopts this neoliberal policy, which leads to privatization of water, privatization of electricity, municipal or council housing is also privatized. So the constitution makes certain promises, social justice promises, but they're immediately undercut by this macroeconomic policy. As you know, ultimately, some people will say, it is the economy that determines everything, how the economy is shared.
Yeah.
So that's one issue, the undercutting of these promises. Two, the constitution does not say anything about reparation. So you don't see the word reparation at all in the constitution. You don't see the word redress. You don't see the word restitution in the constitution, what I call the three R's of decolonization, restitution, reparation, redress, completely missing. So it says, and of course, as you know, the longest clause in the constitution in chapter 2, which is a Bill of Rights, the longest clause is about property.
Yes.
That's the longest clause.
Section 25.
Section 25, that guarantees property. So white people, you will keep your property, your ill-gotten gains. Black people, you'll have social economic rights. I mean, what is that, you know?
Yeah, but just to I mean, press you on this point. Neoliberalism, you're absolutely right, gets adopted by the late 1990s, neoliberal economic policies. But it's a black government. So it's a democratically elected black government with massive majority that could have adopted different policies.
Could have.
Number one. We talk about the guarantee of property in the Constitution and Section 25, but Section 25, as we also know, allows for appropriation and redistribution, albeit with compensation being paid. Now, again, the levels of compensation, etc., could have been articulated and managed in a variety of different ways. And the point is that it was consecutive black governments, black majority governments, that and the of the ANC that didn't do this.
Yeah.
So, of course, the 1996 Constitution is not a redistributive revolution, but the people in charge are the ANC. So, when we criticize the constitutional moment, we have to really kind of keep that in mind and also say, well, what were the tensions? What were the alternatives? What was the road not taken? And judge that past, you know, the recent past in those terms. So how do you meet that? You know, because I think there's a sort of tendency to say it's the fault of the Constitution. But the Constitution is run and you know, it's the South Africa is governed by governments.
That's right.
I mean, obviously, there's this debate around constitutional supremacy, and that it's not parliamentary supremacy; it's constitutional supremacy that you have in place. But it is also democratically elected black governments that are not taking a more radical social and economic path.
Absolutely. I mean, every document can be stretched, be stretched to the limits. As you say, you've got the right to property, but expropriation is also allowed. So on the one level, we are talking about political will. Why was there no political will to do so? There was a time under President Thabo Mbeki, the ANC had a two-third majority. So they could do a lot of things. It's not a parliamentary sovereignty, but with a two-thirds majority, you can do a lot of things without restrictions. Three, going back to Nelson Mandela, a lot of international will, goodwill, to see him succeeding. So it's not like the Mugabe situation where he tends to take land and then Britain, the United States, impose sanction. Maybe that will not have happened under Mandela. So there was no political will to do so. There was no political will to fundamentally redistribute power, economic power. And the answer to that, people say it's this ANC sold out. Now, that's a very simplistic analysis. So what I do in my work, as you know, I go back to the 18th century to say, what was the response of black people to colonization? What was their constitutional vision? In the sense of what was the vision that they put forward as a counter to this settler constitutionalism or constitution making? And we see that there was a split within the indigenous response. There was two responses. One said, look, we have been defeated by superior technology, by the Magnum, by the Canon. Mm-hmm. We have to surrender, but what we should do is to become like these people. So Western education and Christianity as vehicles towards civilization. But not only civilization, as vehicles towards tools that will make us function in this new world. So in assimilative posture, unlike in other places, assimilation was not a policy, a strict policy of Britain. It was black people who said, we want to be part of this so that we can be part of the colonial civil society. But part of that was, therefore, we don't want the land back. We want to be able to buy the land. We want to be able to compete with everyone, get good jobs, be able to compete with everyone. So the one side, the dominant side of black response of a constitution vision is not decolonization, but democratization, civil rights for everyone, and the ability for people to buy land where they want to buy. So the ANC comes from this educated black elites.
Right.
They come study in England, they go study in the United States of America, you know, and they come back and say civilized rights, civil rights for civilized men. You can talk about the Freedom Charter and so forth, but the ANC was always about how do we create conditions where people can be able to compete. So it's not only a sellout. It's a sense that the ANC never wanted to do this. So
it wasn't part of their horizon or
it wasn't
aspiration.
Part of their emancipatory horizon, you know, in a sense. So they could have done this. But of course, the other nefarious influence is the fact that a lot of black people who are politically connected, who are in the ANC, get to benefit from black economic empowerment. So overnight, people are millionaires, overnight, without doing much. Billionaires. A lot of people within the ANC, you know, get to benefit from this policy of assimilating a layer of black people. So the notion that you must radically redistribute the land is not there. But going back to the constitution, so no reparations, no redress, number one. Number two, the constitution does not say what does it seek to transform exactly. What is this thing? So in the preamble, it talks about conflict of the past. We acknowledge there were conflicts of the past. We seek to build a society, build on social justice and so forth. The word apartheid is missing in the preamble.
Yes.
It's missing in the whole constitution.
Yes.
The word colonialism is completely missing from this constitution. Now, I always say to my students, the constitution is a bifocal document. It says we are looking back to this kind of problem that we are seeking to fix. And this is a future society that we are trying to build. Now, if you can't name the issue, you only talk about conflict. And as I said in the beginning, there was no conflict. There was war against indigenous people. So this misremembering.
Or
this
forgetting. There's also almost a deliberate forgetting.
A collective amnesia, one poet calls it, you know, collective amnesia. You know, a deliberate forgetting, a saying we need to move forward, but without naming what are we avoiding, what are we seeking not to happen again.
What are you moving away from?
And then when you talk about the life worlds that a constitution must reconstitute, it must reconstitute on the basis of what was the problem. Now, if the problem, as I said, was illegal leafy, the land is dead. And the answer to that, of course, was my boy, Africa. Africa return. Africa remember. Remember is in R-E-member. Remember. Africa resurrect. So resurrect these lands. is missing from the constitution. As you know, you've also written about this, the word Ubuntu was in the interim constitution.
Yes.
It's not in the
1996.
The so-called version. Final constitution. Yes. So the cosmology of this constitution is dubious, to say the least. The national lens and philosophy of this constitution is missing, you know. In my language, constitution is molaotheo, a foundation law. Mm-hmm. So the constitution must found something. This constitution has failed to found something because it was never meant to reconstitute anything. It was built on politics of reconciliation. Now, reconciliation, there was never conciliation. What reconciliation are you talking about? So you really have to think much more than that, you know? So I always say, if you look at the constitution, there are five crises of constitution in South Africa. Mm-hmm. And by constitution, I don't mean a document. Mm-hmm. I mean constituting or constere in Latin, to stand together, for founding a post-colonial, post-segregation society. Number one, there's still a bifurcated life, in a sense that black lives continue to be cheap. Mm-hmm. You know, you can look at all the statistics, from crime to disasters, who does it affect, to maternal, infant mortality. You can look at all of that. Black lives continue to be cheap. As I said, 34 minors are killed, broad daylight, premeditated, no one goes to jail. So there's still that hierarchy in terms of life. But two, as you know, indigenous law continues to be subservient to Western law. On paper, the two laws must be equal. There must be equivalence, legal equivalence. And that's what decolonization also means, that not that you dump Western law. I mean, that's silly. You can't do that. But there must be some equivalence. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Not even supremacy, some equivalence. What some people call legal pluralism, if you want. We don't have that. Indigenous law is still measured for its validity in terms of Western law. Mm-hmm. I can give so many examples. So there is that bifurcation once again. Three indigenous kingdoms are still not sovereign. You'll remember that the condition of possibility of the colonial state was the conquest of indigenous sovereigns, indigenous kingdoms. The last one being in 1896 with the Zulu kingdom. Now, decolonization must mean a certain resurrection in terms of recognition of these kingdoms, but they're still subservient to the colonial. So the colonial state form has not been dismantled. It's been transformed, but not dismantled, in the sense that, as I said, the kingdoms, the sovereigns, they're still subjugated. And then four, this idea of what Mahmoud Mamdani calls citizens and subjects. That under colonialism, black people were subjects and white people were citizens. Continues today. 20 million black South Africans still live under something called customary law. I mean, you don't know what is this silly thing called customary law. Under the subject of kings. Mm-hmm. Now, I must say that some black people want to belong to both orders. They want to belong to the Western order and the indigenous order. But the post-apartheid state has made sure that that's bifurcated. Citizens and subjects continues. And then lastly, I would say that the last crisis of constitution is, you see it in the fact that the settler-native relations continue. A settler is not just somebody who comes to your land and stays there. I mean, that's migration, that's fine. But a settler, in a colonial context, somebody who comes, dispossesses you and continues to dispossess you. As long as there's not been a return of the land, a sharing of the land, not just a return, you can even say sharing of the land, the settler-native relations continue. So I talk about these five crises of constitution that at the deeper level shows that we have failed to reconstitute or even constitute a new society. So I talk about a paradox of a constitutionalism without constitution, a paradox of constitutionalism without constitution.
Yeah, so it's a failure to reconstitute. It's a failure to...
So there is constitutionalism. The state is limited. The state is subject to the constitution. But there's no constitution. So what does it mean to exist in this paradox of constitutionalism without constitution?
Okay. So earlier you mentioned the lack of redress, restitution and reparations. So that is one of the ways in which one can look back at what has happened, and indeed it's ongoing. It's not just something that happened before 1994. It's an ongoing violence and dispossession that needs to be addressed. So there's a question of redress, and there's a question of through what processes and with what devices do you address this, you know, five-part constitutional crisis?
Yes, and of course the answer for us was you have a constitution which will talk about how do we belong in this territory called South Africa, what rights you have, what obligations you have, you can vote. So a constitution with civil rights, with socio-economic rights. But to supplement that, you need to build a nation. You need to nation build, because there was no nation during apartheid and colonialism. So there had to be a nation-building exercise. It's well and good to have a constitution, even a revolutionary constitution. But if you don't have a nation, then there's no social compact. Then there's no social justice framework that you can agree to. So 1995, the Truth and Reconciliation Commission is established via an act. This is mandated by the interim constitution. The interim constitution is post-Embole, not the preamble, but the post-Embole says there must be a process for reconciliation and healing. So the Truth and Reconciliation Commission is formed. Significantly, it is Truth and Reconciliation, not TRJC. The J is missing.
Yeah.
Justice is missing. So that's one. And the deal is very simple. Perpetrators will come, they will not confess, but they will tell the truth of what happened. They will connect that to a political motive and they will get amnesty. Victims will come and they'll be recognized as victims and they'll get reparations. Very simple deal. And hopefully that will lead us to three things. One, as complete a picture as possible about what happened so that we know what happened. Why was my family targeted? Why was my community targeted for underdevelopment, for, you know, for terror? Two, a recognition of victims, because of course under colonialism and apartheid, under any oppression, there's denial that people are suffering. There's denial that people are victims. So recognition of victims and hopefully to restore their dignity. And then three, from those two, you'll have nation building. You'll have a coming together based on understanding, based on healing, and therefore you know what to avoid going forward. So that is also a constituting thing, because it's a platform for being, becoming, being togetherness. You have also spoken about that. An individualized process. An individual perpetrator will come and say, Tshepo, I did shoot your mother. And because your mother, I thought was a political threat or member of the ANC. And that's what happened. An individual victim, therefore. So it's individualized in that sense. Apartheid as... Our colonialism is a structure, you know, it's a world, it's a structure, it's not a series of individual incidents.
Yes, it's a structure and a system, and what you're saying is that this was individualized.
Individualized.
You talked about victims and perpetrators.
That's
right. Just to clarify, it wasn't that your mother was actually killed.
No, you're
using,
not my mother.
Using that as an example.
But I can use a personal example which says that we are victims of the migrant labor system. We are a victim of racial capitalism.
Yes.
I grew up without my father.
Yes.
And we know the consequences of that.
Yes.
Splitting of families, splitting of communities, and so forth. So we are victims.
Yes.
And they are beneficiaries of the system. But the structure of migrant labor, the structure of racial capitalism It's not on time. So I can't even go to the TRC myself and say, I was a victim of colonialism and apartheid. So the structure, the economic structure, the racial capitalism, migrant labor, the very essence of oppression is not there. So individualized, the system, the structure is not in question. But then three, white people as a beneficiary group are absent completely. As I said, it's only individual victims and individual perpetrators. White people without doing anything, overnight, they are members of this new South Africa. They don't have to do anything at all. But of course, for individual perpetrators, they have to get amnesty. Then they can say, yes, now we are part of this new society. But white people, they say, I mean, every conflict has got beneficiary. Now, under racial capitalism, the system benefits those who are not racialized. So white people don't have to do anything, meaning that the economic question is completely absent. The land question is completely absent from the debate. Number four, the issue of time. So we know that colonialism means the death of the life world, but it also means the interruption of the natural march of history. So it's a interruption of history. It's world breaking in that sense. So it's your time comes to a stop because you don't develop. You are shrunk as a native who lives in the native reserves and so forth. So the issue of time is important, but the TRC, its architecture of time was a Western architecture of time, which is linear. Time is linear. That's why you could talk about transitional justice. So the TRC says, this is what happened in the past. We are moving forward. In fact, that's some of the titles of Desmond Tutu's book, Desmond Tutu being the chairperson of the TRC. You know, something about, you know, moving, looking back to look forward. That's the title of one of the books. But of course, we know in African understanding of time, time is not linear. Time is cyclical. So there's that violence of time, of temporality. It's very, very serious because people who are outside that understanding of time are not recognized, even dismissed. There's a famous book called There Was This Goat. Goat as in the animal. There was this goat. And talks about briefly eight mothers whose kids were killed. And they give testimony and all seven of them become not only recognized, become famous. Books are written, documentaries. But there's this one mother who no one can understand what the hell is she saying as she's giving testimony. And what the hell is she saying? Not that it was not translated live, but that it doesn't make sense. Her narrative does not make sense. She would tell a story, she would go back, she would go forward. In the middle, then she said there was this goat. But of course, for her, goat was the ancestor coming to her. So that violence of time becomes important, you know. And of course, South Africa is built on this violence of time. Transitional justice, post-apartheid, final constitution, new South Africa. If you're not part of understanding discursively,
These punctuations and pivots of time, right?
That's right. And if you're not part of the new South Africa, part of this finally constituted world, part of the post-apartheid South Africa, there's something wrong with you as an individual. The problem is with you. So that violence of time, but that violence of time, number five, is related to the violence of epistemology, the violence of legality. The TRC legal system was a Western legal system. How you understand the evidence, how you understand what is truthful, but also its understanding of forgiveness, which was also a central pillar of the TRC, was based on Christianity. Not only because Desmond Tutu, the deputy, and a lot of other commissioners were Christians. African cosmology or African humanism says, yes, there must be forgiveness, but forgiveness must be based on certain things. There must be truth, there must be justice, and there must be restitution, you know, all of that. So this Western imposition of legality and theology or Christianity, the TRC, there had to be a process of reharmonization. There had to be a process of looking back to look forward. But the way it was done, but even the timing of it, and maybe that's the sixth point, the timing is that it happens in 1996. 1996, war is still going, still ongoing in KwaZulu-Natal, is still ongoing in the East Rand. People are still being killed actively. War is still, massacres are still happening. Now, how can you have a process of, you know, the advocates for truth and reconciliation commission, they call it a table of humanity. Mm-hmm. How do you have a table, a platform of humanity when people are still displaced, people are still being killed? So the timing was off. But also very short time, 2 years, 1996 to 1998, that's it. How is that possible when you are dealing with such a long history? But also the TRC's time was a very limited time from Sharpeville massacre in the 1960 to 1994.
Mm-hmm.
Very, very limited time.
Mm-hmm.
Colonialism was, as I said, from 1654, 1659, people say, 52 or 59, depending on which timeline you use, apartheid from 1948. But then the window of the TRC is very, very short.
So given this analysis, and for reasons of time for us, it poses the many fundamental questions. One is about redress and reparations. How does one approach that now, number one? Number two, what can be done with this constitution, both in the constitution, the document, but also constitution in the broader sense that you've been talking about? Where do we go with that? And, you know, here we are 30 years from that process you've been describing so eloquently. Where do you see things getting to in 30 years' time? You know, are you hopeful? Are you? Do you see avenues for these issues to be addressed?
Well, I'm I think a scholar activist in a sense that I was in the university or still in the university, but I was also in civil society, and I was in civil society activism to, one, be in solidarity with people who are struggling actively on the ground, you know, as social movements. So I've been part of a lot of social movements. I've formed new social movements and so forth. So I believe in using this constitution. You know, some of my friends say the constitution is, as you've described it, you know, don't even touch it. It's a tool of false consciousness. Even if you win a bit, you are losing actually. But also you have been co-opted in neoliberalism, in liberal democracy and so forth. But that's a very naive and elitist way of thinking about the constitution and thinking about struggle. Impoverished people, so-called poor people, have to use every weapon that they can find. They have to march today. They have to do sit-in today. They have to, I don't know, some of them, you know, inconvenience us by blocking roads and so forth. But they must also go to court. They must also go to court. So I have used this constitution and sometimes, you know, in ways that are beneficial. I approach the constitution tactically, not as a strategy, but as a tactic, as part of a number of tactics. Go to court, have an opening that you can use for counter-institutional purposes or even if you want to call it revolutionary purposes outside of that, you know. So the constitution is not, it's not a tool for revolution, it's not a tool for decolonization, but it is there. And it's one of the tools impoverished people must use it. Now, as you said earlier, I'm a human rights commissioner. A human rights commissioner gets his legitimacy or her legitimacy or their legitimacy from the constitution. The human rights commission is established by the constitution. So after I was appointed, I gave an interview and I said, I'm there to radicalize the constitution. Mm-hmm. So what does it mean to radicalize the constitution? This constitution that is limited. What does it mean to stretch it as far as possible? Of course, I don't have all the answers, but I'm interested in that. How do we stretch it as much as possible? You spoke about Section 25, which makes provision for expropriation. Of course, it could have been much more clearer that it's with nil compensation under the circumstances. So there are avenues to do that. There are avenues to do that. But if we want to reconstitute South Africa, if we want to reconstitute these life worlds that have been killed, I submit we need a post-conquest constitution. Mm-hmm. A post-conquest constitution which will attend to, which will say the problem was settler colonization. Mm-hmm. The solution is to have a society that is post-colonial. And I say for me, I don't have an answer about what is this constitution will look like. Mm-hmm. But I know that it must have three pillars, three essential pillars of this constitution. So I've suggested that the three pillars will be, number one, a dismantling of the colonial state. South Africa, this country without a name, that is just called South Africa. I mean,
yes.
We can have a whole podcast about the implication of being a country without a name.
Yes.
What does that mean? A country imposed by a settler, by settler colonizers. What does it mean? But the colonial state form is still there. It's been transformed. It's been democratized. A new government, but a new state. Not a new state. So the dismantling of the colonial state, that should be the first pillar. The second pillar must be this three R's of decolonization, a constitution that makes it very clear that to build a new society, you need to have reparations. I mean, there's no doubt about it. You can't have a society where there's been a crime against humanity, and that crime against humanity was based on exploitation, not genocide, but exploitation and extractivism of spirituality, of labor, of all sorts of things. But when you come to the new society, white people don't lose anything. I mean, I've said this publicly, you can't have social justice with white people not losing anything. No, you can't have that. People say, no, but you can have a society where you uplift black people. There's no uplifting in a colonial context unless there's been fundamental reparation, restitution, and redress, a fundamental sharing. And that must be at the center of the constitution. This constitution responds to colonialism, and it will seek to have reparations at its center. Not forever, but for a certain period until there's, equivalence somehow. So not socioeconomic rights, but reparation at its center, reparative justice at its center. And then lastly, a constitution that says our cosmology, the cosmology of this constitution, the lens of this constitution is African. It's African, right? That this constitution is based, when you look at the Bolivia constitution, it's based on this concept of summa causa, good living. And that comes from indigenous people. That is the lens of the constitution. Before you come to individual clauses, at the heart of this constitution is this notion of good living, bon vivir. It's the same with the Ecuadorian constitution. Mm-hmm. So constitution always have lenses, always have an ideology. It's not good enough to say transformative, because we know once you do that, the lens is Western and liberal, right? So the third pillar would be a pillar that seeks to not reconstitute materially, not restitute materially, but restitute from a cultural, from a spiritual lens. So that would be, for me, a constitution that responds to the national question. What is the national question in South Africa? How do you build, how do you reconstitute a nation? So to go to the next 30 years, you're asking, what is the next 30 years under this constitution? I think we'll still be in the same thing, situation. You'll have some judges who try to push it a bit here, victories here, mm-hmm. but ultimately you will never achieve a, you'll never answer those five crises of mm-hmm. constitution. You'll never reconstitute the constitution. You'll have a space where I said black people are still pariahs mm-hmm. in South Africa. Black people will only, or presently black people benefit if they can assimilate. You know, all of us, our wish is that our kids should go to a white school so they can be able to perform mm-hmm. Western modernity. They can get good jobs. That is our hope, you know, proper assimilation, which means that pariahdom and the suppression of the life worlds of black people will, not black people, but indigenous people will continue. Mm-hmm. And the question there is that Mahmoud Mamdani asked long time ago, can a settler become native? You know, can a settler become native? That's a very important question, right? Of course, I'm not interested in that because the native only comes to being when the settler arrives. So we must mm-hmm. look towards a world where there's no natives, there's no settlers, mm-hmm. you know. And but how do you do that? How do you do that? White people can become Africans, but they can only be Africans if, one, they embrace Ubuntu. Well, that's the third one. But the first one is that you can only be African if you agree that African is about living together, mm-hmm. interdependence, communalism, Ubuntu. And there's no Ubuntu where some people have and some people are have-nots. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So the first vehicle towards white people becoming African is for them to give up what they've gained during colonialism and apartheid that continue to divide us. Mm. So they can be harmony. There can't be harmony if some have, some mm-hmm. don't.
Yeah.
And then two, of course, you know, a embracing of Ubuntu, embracing of this ideology of African people. You know, you will know that in my PhD I say a decolonized world is not a world where we've retrieved native discourse or native epistemologies. It's a creolization world, a world where we are actively creolizing and mixing, not hybridity, but mixing different influences. So that is a national question. How do white people move from what Eskia Mphahlele, a philosopher, a writer, a poet, calls, move from living on Africa to living in Africa? What does that mean?
Okay. Well, Seppo, as ever, it's been incredibly educative for me to be talking with you. I think you're one of the sharpest, clearest thinkers on these extremely vexed questions around colonization and what it means to achieve emancipation and liberation in that context. So I've learned a huge amount, and I'm sure listeners are going to really enjoy the insights that you've offered. So thank you so much for your time and for joining me on Countersign.
Thank you for having me. I appreciate it.
You've been listening to Countersign. Thank you for joining me. For more information, please visit countersignisapodcast.com.